Hi, I'm Jenny Cowan-Brown.
And I'm Benedict Evans.
And today we have a very insider Silicon Valley story, which is what, the intersection of Silicon Valley tech and tech media? Is that more or less?
Pretty much. So newsletters and all the conversations that spiral off newsletters, which I thought was like an interesting topic for the last podcast before Christmas.
Yeah.
Given that I run a newsletter since early 2013. And started a paid tier this year. And Substack has become one of the hot topics in Silicon Valley. But also, I mean, we were talking about this earlier. It's like it's the intersection of people in Silicon Valley are obsessed with Substack, also other things, but Substack. But it's also an obsession for a whole group of journalists, because there's a whole kind of group of journalists who've gone onto Substack and everybody else is interested in what that is. And so there's this sort of interesting intersection of media people, newspaper people talking about newsletters and tech people talking about newsletters. Should mention as a disclaimer that my former employer, Andreessen Horowitz, invested in Substack. I wasn't involved in that. And so there's just a kind of an interesting, like, swirling mass here because, I mean, Craigslist started as a newsletter. Email newsletters have been around probably since before the web.
I didn't know Craigslist started as a newsletter.
Yeah, it was a list. So it was an email list. And he would put things in it, and at a certain point he had to make it into a website because there was too much stuff. So Craigslist, newsletters are older than the web, or as old as the web. And then the web came and sort of squashed everything else. Like every other form of content got subsumed into the web. And email newsletters were sort of a thing in the 90s and early, in the 90s and early 2000s, but the web was a thing. I started a newsletter in 2013, and at that time, it was not like a thing that everyone in tech was doing. I actually did it at the suggestion of a colleague from investment banking, because equity analysts do newsletters. And so you should do a newsletter, but it was coming from that, not coming from tech. And then in the last year or two, it's become a huge thing again.
Everyone seems to have one, especially during the pandemic. It's been interesting that it's the joke of you either start a newsletter or a podcast.
Or both.
You went paid, started a podcast. Oh, both, exactly. I started one actually on Substack as well, which was interesting. I have to say there's something there for me that, I don't know, it's been top of mind for me of why all the hype around Substack, because it hasn't reinvented anything, to your point. And it came top of mind for us because they just announced that they've got now the RSS feed, which I've loved the debates between, are you a civilized person and do you have an RSS feed for all your newsletters, or do you get everything barbarically sent to your inbox?
Yeah, like an animal.
Like an animal. I actually discovered, looking at the RSS feed, that somehow in the last 7 months I've subscribed to 72 newsletters, which is just not okay.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, exactly. Bloody hell is the right response to that.
Well, I suppose there's a bunch of different threads, because this is the rebirth of blogging. And you call it a newsletter. I actually write a newsletter in that it's news and it's 20 different things. Quite a lot of what people are doing is actually writing. It's long form writing.
It's blog posts, yeah.
In this new except in this new format. The second thing is distribution, in that RSS, or rather, distribution means two different things. It's as in RSS never really became a consumer thing and RSS died. And remembering to go to a blog is different from just entering your email address and you get the thing.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is payment. And no one ever really managed to make paid, other than big newspapers, no one really ever managed to make paid content for individual small-scale stuff work. And yet somehow paying for a newsletter feels different, or the psychology of it feels different. And there's also that links to the whole journalists going independent, people going independent, people creating their own business, as opposed to this just being the new content format. And there's also, I think, a sort of, like a discovery question or a format question in here, which sort of comes to the, like, why had blogging gone away? Because I feel like Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter, between them sort of killed mainstream blogging in the 2000s and the early teens. And this is kind of a rebirth of that. And so Medium was like a precursor to this. Medium is like John the Baptist to Substack is Jesus, obviously. Medium is like the early echo of this. I'm sorry, Ev, if you're listening. But Medium, again, is like, and there's also a tools thing in here. And not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but, you know, setting up a newsletter on Campaign Monitor or MailChimp is relatively straightforward, but getting the archive and payment and all of that, the whole stack lined up with Stripe, is actually really, you know, fiddly. You know, if you're a software engineer, it's trivial. But if you're not a software engineer and you don't want to write API calls and you kind of look at like Stripe's API and think, I don't really don't want to start trying to integrate that into WordPress by myself, then it's fiddly.
Yeah.
And so Substack kind of came along and said, okay, it's one thing. It's the sign up. It's the archive page. It's the payment. It's the subscription. It's the email. It's the whole thing, all kind of wrapped up with a bow tie around it. And we take 10%. It's free if you're not charging. We take 10% if you're not. And so rather like Medium is much easier than WordPress. Substack is also easier than WordPress plus Stripe plus MailChimp plus 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 plus. And so you can just go and get started.
And that's the point, isn't it? And I don't know if they actually said that, but there's a whole piece around, you know, how this is democratizing the writing experience and allowing for more people to be able to start this off, which is the whole democratization piece is one that I've been thinking about for a long time. We used that at my old company as well, that we were democratizing politics and, you know, it shouldn't be so expensive and so complicated to run for office. And so we're going to lower that barrier. And same thing, like provide a platform and tools that are affordable, fairly easy to use. And when it's a platform, I kind of agree with that. When you're buying tools, like the democratization of how affordable and how easy these tools are. When it's something like a Substack or that's related to content, I always have a little bit of a harder time with it, because the whole idea of democratizing this, the people who are or who are going to be really successful on these types of content distribution models are generally people who already have a big audience. And so it's somewhat easier for them to, you know, hit the ground running and make a lot of money. So there's a democratization piece that I'm not sure I completely agree with.
Well, so let's pull this platform word apart for a second, because so I have a website which gets traffic and it's on Squarespace and I pay Squarespace money. And they do not give me traffic at all. They provide technology. I buy the technology. After that, it's entirely in my hands. The same thing if I was to go back to using WordPress. WordPress doesn't give me traffic. It's a tool. It's a piece of technology that I pay a monthly subscription for. But they don't give me traffic any more than I write a book in Word and so Microsoft will get me readers.
There's no visibility because you're on Squarespace.
Yeah, so it's Squarespace, WordPress, Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, Photoshop. It's a piece of software that I use as a tool. As opposed to Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, where you have both a tool and a network. And yes, you can tell people to look at your Instagram, but actually the point is that it's a network that will drive traffic to you and it will have a recommendation system and will say, well, you're interested in these Japanese ceramicists, so I'll show you some other Japanese ceramicists. You're interested in Formula One, I'll show you more Formula One stuff. And so it's trying to suggest out of like the infinite content, and this is the thing we said, there is infinite content, there is infinite stuff you could look at. Yeah. And so it's out, or there is that great thing you didn't know about and you would never have heard about it, so I'm going to show it to you. So there is a tool and then there is a network, which is a recommendation suggestion system on top of that. Tumblr was sort of halfway between the two of those, because it was a tool, but there was also like a network and a recommendation system around it, because there was all the kind of the what was it called? There was like a liking model. I had a Tumblr for a couple of years.
Is it still around?
It is, yeah. It's owned by Verizon. So it's like just, it was bought by Yahoo, disappeared into Verizon. It does still exist, but it sort of faded away. And Medium was also like an interesting midpoint, because it was your Medium page, but it was a Medium page, not a page. You know, I don't have a Squarespace site. You wouldn't go to my webpage and know it was Squarespace unless you really need, you have to really be technical to know about that. But it is a Medium page, not a page. And Medium, again, was about building a network that would drive, A, it was the tool, but it was also driving traffic to you. It would give you distribution. LinkedIn does this too, incidentally. Chris Dixon at A16Z had this line, come for the tool, stay for the network.
Yeah.
So you come for the tool, but then the network is what will get people to read you. So this is to this point, what do you mean by the word distribution? Again, do you mean the physicality of like an SMTP server, like it sends mail? Or do you mean that's what Squarespace does. You know, Squarespace is an HTTP server. That's quote unquote distribution. No, that's not what we mean. Distribution is discovery and recommendation and suggestion. Can they get you users? And so to your point, this is like this interesting question for Substack. Is if I go there as nobody, can they get me users? Well, they suggest people, oh, you should read Benedict's stuff. Or do I have to go out and get that myself?
I'd argue the latter.
And for MailChimp, the answer is no, you go out and get your own. Like, we'll charge you X per user and the rest is up to you. For Medium or for Instagram, the answer is yes, we'll try and drive you users and recommendation and suggestion. This is this fantastic word, algorithm, which really just means like formula or equation. And Substack is in this kind of interesting place in the middle where, like, on one level, they are a Squarespace or a MailChimp. They're a tool and you pay them, or if you're charging, you pay. If you're not charging, it's free. And that's it, which is what Squarespace is. But there's also a leaderboard. Yeah. And there is a substack.com.
Which I have never been to.
And there's a page where you go to which suggests stuff. And they're in this sort of ambivalent position of which are we?
Yeah.
I mean, what is it that we're going to do? And this gets you to the content recommendation question. Content moderation question, where they say, well, we're not, you know, they haven't really answered the question of what do we think about content moderation, other than to say, if it's bad, we'll take it down, which is like the whole question. Yes, but what's bad? The interesting thing about that is that MailChimp takes stuff down. So MailChimp took down this Australian anti-vax campaigner, and MailChimp has no algorithm at all. There's no recommendations. So you go to MailChimp.com, you would not discover who any MailChimp customers are, except from like the marketing page. But they won't like suggest you other MailChimps.
But they make editorial decisions.
But they still take some editorial decisions that we're not going to have that on our platform, even though it's not illegal. So there's the illegal, which is easy. There's the do we let people say that vaccines cause cancer? Well, MailChimp have said no, even though there's no algorithm at all. Substack haven't really answered that question. But it kind of comes to this thing in the middle that they have this sort of slightly ambivalent position that algorithms are bad and we're not going to do that. And you're in control of what you see, which is fine until you've signed up to 100 newsletters. And then you say, well, do I go and do I see whichever was sent most recently, which is actually an algorithm. It's just a randomization algorithm. You know, who sent one at 7:62 and who sent 7:52 and who sent one at 8:05 and who sent one at 8:15? Well, those are the first three I see. That's randomization. Do I see that, or do I see the one I always open? Do I see the one that I delete after reading quickly? Do I suggest showing you less of the one that you always delete? Do I show you the one where you always click on links? That's a recommendation algorithm. And once you've signed up to 50 or 100 or 200, then you start having that conversation. What happens if I go to the homepage of Substack? Should it look at my feed and say, you've signed up to loads of people who say stuff about tech strategy. Here are some others about tech strategy. Oh, you don't do that. Well, if you're not going to do any of that, which is fine, then why am I paying you 10%? Are you going to get me users, or am I bringing you my users? And if I'm bringing you my users, that's fine. If I'm Jesse What's-His-Name or Noah What's-His-Name or Bill Bishop, or on the other hand, Glenn Greenwald. If you've got your audience and you take it to Substack, that's fine. And Substack isn't giving you more users. Okay, why are you paying 10% in that case?
The business model for me is really interesting as well, because, and I agree with it, like I like the idea of the business model, but I also had this moment of, I just started a newsletter. I'm not planning on going paid anytime soon. Hence, they are never really going to care about me because I'm not bringing them any money. So they're never going to help me grow my audience. And why should they? Mm. And I remember talking with someone at Substack at the start of the year of, are you actually just the software, or do you want to be something more? Because if you're just the software, then I don't think you ever have to worry that much about content moderation. But the moment that you're a little bit more, in my opinion, than just the software, then the content moderation piece is a huge part of your business.
This is where you get this really interesting sort of, I mean, there was a piece somebody wrote that said, look at all the people on the leaderboard at Twitter, on Substack. You know, they're all well-established big brand, big names. All white men, which is basically because they all entered journalism 30 years ago.
Exactly.
So they're all people who have a pre-existing audience. Substack didn't give them users. Can Substack give you users? Well, the answer is only if they have an algorithm.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, what do you mean they can, how can they give you readers without doing recommendations? And if they're doing recommendations, they become Facebook.
And I think that's, you just hit the nail on the head there for me of why I have an issue with that democratization piece as well, because you're not actually allowing it to be easier for people to start newsletters, because you can start the newsletter, you can start writing, but you need an audience if you're going to grow that newsletter. And so there's a lot of work that you need to do on your own.
As opposed to MailChimp or Tiny Letter or Campaign Monitor, setting aside the fact that it's free, but yeah, I mean, MailChimp doesn't cost anything for if you've only got a couple of hundred readers. I mean, it costs me quite a lot because I bet I've got 150,000 subscribers. So like, yeah, they charge me for that. I send more than 500,000 emails a month. So like, I'm kind of happy paying Ben Chestnut some money for that. But if you come there with no audience and you're on MailChimp, it's on you to get the readers. It's not on MailChimp. If I go to Substack and I've got no audience, is it now on Substack? Are they different or is it just MailChimp with a different business model? And Glenn Greenwald is paying for your free emails.
And they've done something very clever with the lead generation as well, that it's so obvious now when you receive a newsletter, if it's a Substack newsletter. Like, it just looks like a Substack newsletter. And I can't remember actually if it says at the bottom.
That's why I don't use it.
That's why you don't use it. But you've already got a brand. You've already established a brand. You've got your colour.
But that's also what Medium did.
And look, it's what Nation Builder did. You'd have to pay a lot of money to white label the newsletters. Mm. But if you were sending a newsletter using the Nation Builder software, it would say at the bottom, created with Nation Builder, which was a very clever way for journalists to see which political parties and which candidates were actually paying Nation Builder money to use their software. They would go around going, oh, okay, this is interesting. And I've seen this with the lead gen with Substack. It's so obvious when it's a Substack newsletter, which gets people excited of, oh, it looks
good. Do you know where that started?
No.
Hotmail. So one of the strokes of genius with Hotmail, well, there were lots of strokes of genius with Hotmail, but one of them was that every Hotmail email said, sent with Hotmail, get your free email here. Of course, this is in the days when, like, how would you get email, like from your school or your company or maybe your ISP? And Hotmail, no, there'll be an actual email, will be a separate thing. And so they had this link at the bottom, which gave you this viral loop. And that's the same thing with Substack. And it's the same thing with Hotmail and obviously with Medium and so on. And again, it's like, is this a, what do we mean by platform? Is this a network? Maybe that's a better way to use. Is this a tool or a network? Because platform, distribution, those terms mean anything. Is it a tool or a network? If it's a network, they can get you users and they can charge. If it's a tool, and they have content moderation questions. If it's a tool, fine, but then why is it branded Substack? Because it's not now. It's like if you write a book, you don't get to see that it was made in Word. Like, well, that illustration was done in Photoshop. Yeah. You know, you can't tell that my website is Squarespace, but you could tell it was Medium. And so what is that? How do they think about that?
And that leads to something that's interesting as well with the rise of, and you and I spoke about this briefly, but the rise of communities in companies these days as well. I think specifically with the pandemic, that rise of wanting a community has become exponential. And I've seen it with Substack also, this desire to want to build a writer's community. And I think that's also a thing is you know, what does it mean when you start building a community of people and you start deciding who is part of that community? Mm. You're also taking an editorial choice there as well, which I understand the benefit of the community, but it starts blurring the line.
I mean, I think the other interesting thing we're seeing here is payment, which we mentioned at the beginning. And, you know, I considered ages ago having a paywall on my website, and I concluded that I didn't feel like I wrote enough to be able to justify paying. And very few people have managed to make a website paid. What Ben Thompson did, and he started his newsletter roughly the same time as mine, back in sort of 2013 or so, he started paid at the beginning. At that time, it was, you know, a nightmare to get it all to work. There was no Substack there. And I was just about to join A16Z, so that was like...
Point.
Mark Andreessen said that Andreessen Horowitz is a media company that monetizes through venture capital. So that was my revenue model, was get Andreessen Horowitz to pay me lots of money to write stuff on the internet.
Smart.
Again, we'll get paid to dick around on the internet. It's great. Sorry, Margaret. But the point was, like, I suppose what I'm trying to blathering about is that, like, it's somehow an email. A, it's easier to write an email about what happened that week or that day than to come up with like an actual original idea for a blog post. Every week. Secondly, because you've got like a trigger. And secondly, I feel like an email has more like physicality and more tangible value. So it feels like you've got a thing that you still have and can own.
Yeah.
And you're getting, it's coming to you. So it feels like you're getting this ongoing service as opposed to subscribing to a website that you've got to remember to go to. It's like, yeah, I never go to it. And am I going to go back? And how often do they write? And like the email is this thing you're being given and you're being reminded all the time that you're getting this value. And so it feels like charging, and then when you add the layer of like Stripe and then you know, so the Substack and so on, it becomes much more viable to charge for that. Whether you can charge for podcasts is another interesting question. But it's that same point. I mean, the challenge here is partly, though, I mean, if we sort of go back to like Instagram and what have you, that there's a sort of, it's to my point about what happens when you've got 200 newsletters. I always think of these things as being a bit like slash and burn agriculture. And you've got this great new empty field and you plant stuff. And then after like a while, this is a crap analogy. The point is it fills up. So you create this new channel and there's nothing there. And you can go and you can build a new site and you're the first person. And everyone thinks, wow, this is great. This is a new form. 3 years later, there's 10,000 newsletters. There's 10,000, there's a million, billion people on Instagram. There's a million podcasts. Whatever the new channel is, it has its own attributes, but it also has the attribute of being empty.
Mm.
And then at a certain point, it's not empty anymore. And you're, as a consumer, your feed fills up, the inbox fills up. I've got 200 fucking newsletters. I've got 5,000 podcasts. I haven't listened to them. And you declare bankruptcy and you go, oh, this is new. This Instagram thing, this is interesting.
Yeah.
This email thing, this Substack thing, this is an email, a new subscription, this is interesting. And so there's this kind of repeating cycle that you get a new channel so people can establish themselves in the new channel. They can build up an audience. But at a certain point, there's just so much there that it becomes that vastly harder for a new person to break in, vastly harder for you to consume all the stuff. And that channel fills up and then there's a new channel. And then there's another new channel. And then there's another new channel. And that will be the problem, with email newsletters. So there'll be, when everyone's got 500 of them, and then there'll be a new newsletter tab in Gmail. And it's, I love Ben Thompson, but he keeps saying there's no algorithm in email. Like, Ben, have you looked at your open rates? Because I've looked at mine, and yeah, there is a fucking algorithm. Like,
something's going on.
Yeah, like it moves around 10% sometimes. Like that's not my subject line. That's the algorithm. So, it will fill up. There will be a recommendation algorithm. Or if there isn't, it will just be what time of day you sent it, which, as I said, is like a randomization thing. And then there'll be another thing.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with Instagram. It's what happened with podcasts. And, there are people who are at the top 50 will make lots of money and the next 300 will make something. And then after that, it'll be really hard to break through. And then there'll be something else. Like the cycle will keep going around.
And I think that's the thing that's interesting that we haven't actually spoken about here is that this whole idea of the creator first economy that's sort of obviously been rising ever so slightly. And I think that's solely because of the accessibility and the affordability of all the tools available and all of the new content channels available as well. I also think we're so far behind, and I know very little, about China, but China feels massively ahead of the game with their sort of mentality of tipping creators left, right, and center and paying for certain things. And I love this idea of, you can read 90% of a book, and if you actually enjoy it and want to read the last 10%, then you pay for it. There's all of these cool things that are coming out of China, I think, that we're so far behind. And it just gets me excited of what's possible when you think about this creator-first economy. But to your point, at what point does it get so saturated that there's actually only a few amount of people making money?
Well, you talked about the Silicon Valley and newspaper journalist bubble. This guy, Jimmy Donaldson, aka Mr. Beast, who, since I am too old, I genuinely never heard of, he is a top YouTuber. He makes millions of dollars. He just launched a dark kitchen business selling hamburgers. His app, Hamburger Dark Kitchen app, went to the top of the US App Store. So put that in a pipe, Mr. Top 10 Substat leaderboard dude, and think about what real money looks like and what a real leaderboard
Seriously.
Looks like. And so there is a YouTube leaderboard, and there is YouTube creation, and there is TikTok, and there are all the live streaming shopping apps that blow up in China. And email newsletters for like insidery gossip around newspapers and tech strategy are like a super micro niche. Entertaining 10-year-olds, that's where the money's at. Like, come on. A, it's an example of like, we're in the bubble.
Yeah.
B, it's an example of like, there are so many news channels and there are these new channels. And, you want to make money from selling newsletters? No, how about making money from selling hamburgers? What about, where's your merch? What's his name? David Sacks. Is it David Sacks? His name's David Sacks. Yeah, so he's on a podcast with Jason Calacanis and Chamath, unpronounceable name. Sorry, Chamath. I think his ego will survive. And a couple of other people. And they could do a podcast every week talking about poker and startups. And David was like, we would do merch. And the only reason we're not doing merch is to wind up Jason. Because he's so desperate to do merch. And we're just not doing merch because we're all richer than him. So we don't care. Which is why I don't listen to the podcast. But like that whole sense of like, there's so many different ways of disaggregating, unbundling, rebundling attention. If you go to Dumbo in Manhattan, there's a street amongst all the 19th century warehouses where there's a good view of the bridge. And I was there last summer, and there's a queue of like 50 people waiting to have their, you know, there's an Instagram feed called Boyfriends of Instagram.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there you are. The same thing. It's all these people trying to break through. Yeah. And the problem is the channel is full.
You've got the rise of the influencers.
Yeah, the rise of the influencers.
And then the rise of the boyfriends. And with those influencers came the rise of the Instagram boyfriends, which have deep sympathy for them.
Yeah, but it's all, I mean, it's hilarious because you can spot in certain parts of London or New York, you can spot the influencer because like nobody really wears clothes like that. Especially not in this weather, but certainly anyone, nobody actually wears clothes like that. And so you have this sense of kind of continuous, this sort of unbundling of the influencer point. Yeah. You're unbundling from Vogue, or more probably from Elle. You're unbundling from the mid-market, or you're unbundling from Elle Decoration, or from World of Interiors, or you're unbundling from Architectural Digest, or you're unbundling from whatever that traditional media aggregator would be, you're unbundling from it. And then Instagram is rebundling you, or email is rebundling you, or podcasting is rebundling you in another way, or Gmail, or Google, or whatever it is. There's always this bundling-unbundling cycle, which is like the great cliche of tech.
Unbundling and bundling. It's interesting because with the unbundling, there's also, we're taking out the middleman, but actually instead you're putting in an algorithm. Because yes, you're taking out the middleman if you're, you know, taking things away from Vogue and you're stepping into the limelight as an influencer. There's also something that you brought up the other day that I can't remember what prompted that, but you said something like this clearly showcases that there's a desire for more, you know, smaller scale events, that people want less mass communication, that we're in a moment where we want an intimate and more an engaging experience, which I have to say I felt quite a bit. And I was just remembering what was the last, you know, thoughtful decision that I took to have that experience. And then I remember that on election night, which actually wasn't an election night, it was three nights in a row, but I decided...
Election month.
But the three nights where they were trying to count the votes, I decided not to watch traditional media to get my election news, and instead watching Hasan Piken. And I was wondering why I did that on Twitch. And it was interesting because you get an interesting experience when you're watching someone live stream this on Twitch, and you get this like feeling of you're sitting down with a friend and trying to understand what the hell is happening. And there's a lot of clicking around, opening tabs, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And there's an actual engagement and a dialogue that's happening. And I have to say, it was one of the most fun and engaging election night results that I'd had in a long time. So there's definitely something there about that desire for engagement.
So I have like three things that I want to write about. And I'm trying to work out how to not, because they all really intersect, because one of them is about e-commerce.
Yeah.
And the sort of spectrum of e-commerce from logistics to recommendation, experience, discovery. One of my kind of talking points in this is there's a store in Tokyo that just sells one book. So it's a little shop. They have like a table piled of copies of this one book. And every week, or maybe every fortnight, every month, they change. And so you go there and they will talk to you about this book and why you should buy it. Which is like, A, it's a very Japanese thing to be obsessed with the one thing. But B, it's the ultimate kind of curation, recommendation, discovery. And to your point, it's about sort of what I would call doing things that don't scale.
Yeah.
So you've got this fire hose, this infinite content. And I have this experience in Instagram. I've followed enough things that I'm now sort of at the point that I can't keep up with my Instagram feed unless like I spend an hour scrolling. And I'm sort of sitting and thinking, do I want to read all of it, or does it not matter? And is it a sampling anyway? Do I need to see another 50 pictures of, you know, French interiors and Japanese ceramics and like weird German 50s churches? Or have I just seen, always the deal that I'm going to have 10 minutes of seeing that stuff and then I'll do something else? Is it a sample, or do I see the whole thing? Do I scale? Do I want to see everything? Do I want to see like this little sample? Do I want to see that one thing? There is also a thing there in live. And so that, there's an e-commerce story there.
Yeah.
There is a newsletter story here of like, I want to have this one thing as opposed to it being somewhere in the fire hose of Facebook or Twitter. And will I find it again? And it's gone. But if I pay for it, then I've got this email that I won't lose and it'll be there and I have it. My friend of mine was an experimental musician and used to come back from Oakland with audio cassettes. which again was like a way of having like a physical, tangible thing that wasn't part of the fire hose. And so I think there's a piece that something of that is about commerce. Some of it is about newsletters. Some of it is like there's a generalized, like do things that don't scale discussion, which is also about live events, which is also like, how do you step out of the fire hose? And the interesting, the paradox of live events is, A, you want to, that when you take them online, then suddenly somehow you're scaling them again. So the FT Weekend does this literary festival every summer, which is like professors and writers and so on in like three big tents in a park in North London, Kenwood House. And they sell a couple of thousand tickets and it's like 100 quid. And this year, obviously, they couldn't do that. So they put it online at half price and they sold several thousand. They sold like three or four times more tickets. And it's not quite the experience of being there, but it's most of the experience and you don't have to be there. But you can reach people who aren't in London.
Or who couldn't afford that in the first place.
Or couldn't afford it, or but or more weren't in London, okay. I think.
Okay.
And the same point with that little Japanese ceramicist living in his cabin in the mountains in the snow. And it has to be the right kind of snow, obviously, otherwise the plot won't come out right. And like you go to the next hill, the pot will look terrible and you'll just have to smash it and give up and never make pots again. That's how Japanese pots work. But like the point is that like now he can sell to me. And so is that, A, I'm buying this one-of-a-kind handmade thing, but I'm how the hell would I ever have bought it before Instagram? And so there's this kind of, and the same with the event, the same like you want something that doesn't scale, that's one-of-a-kind and specific and isn't mass manufactured, but also the internet lets many more people have unscalable things. I've got to find the perfect paradox in there, but like the internet scales the unscalable or something. Thank you for coming to my TED talk.
But there is something, even, I mean, look, the reality to your point is there's so many tools today that you could spend a whole day going from TikTok to Instagram to Twitter to your RSS feed to Reddit and back and just go round and around and there'll always be content. What's been interesting for me with TikTok is I actually kicked off that account and purposefully was very specific with the content I was putting out there. It was only F1 stuff. And it was interesting that
this is Formula One.
Formula
which is
One.
Kind of car racing.
Which is car racing. Thank you for that definition. Someone told me the other day that they loved your definition for Americans of what F1 was. But I was very...
It's the car racing where they don't go round and round in circles.
That's the one.
They just follow each other around the windy track.
Just go round and round. But what was interesting is I'm growing it very intentionally and very slowly. And I could do the fire hose of I'm going to jump on all of the latest trends of TikTok that will get me in front of the right audience or not won't get me actually in front of the right audiences, but will get me in front of far larger audiences. And I can grow my following exponentially faster. And so there's been something there that's been interesting for me of no, I'm intentionally going after a very specific audience and it's growing slowly, but it's bringing exactly the right people that I want to this page. And hence the engagement is insane. And we're having really interesting and actually collaborative conversations, whereas that wouldn't be the case if I was just jumping on the trends to actually get in front of the wider audience. So there's something there that I've been thinking about of the content that you create and where and who you're trying to attract.
The analogy I was thinking of, which it now occurs to me actually works better than I'd realized, is arts and crafts. Which again, I'll sort of explain and sort of presuming knowledge. So arts and crafts is this movement in Britain at the end of the 19th century, which is a reaction against mass manufactured material culture. So you have all of this mass produced goods. It's partly like steam engines and railways and oh my God, what's going on and how the world is changing. It's also like all of this mass produced furniture, mass produced pottery, mass produced everything. And it's an attempt at sort of, I'm going to butcher the concept terribly, but for the purpose of conversation, it's an attempt at handcrafted things. And of course, if in 1800 you'd said, I only want handcrafted stuff, that would have been like a really completely meaningless statement because everything was handcrafted. In 1870 or 80 or 1890 or whenever exactly it is, it becomes a much more meaningful thing. And, you know, it's sort of linked with pre-Raphaelites and it's linked with a bunch of stuff. But it's that sense of a reaction against the Industrial Revolution, which I think is interesting. And of course, the paradox in this, which is also the paradox I mentioned earlier, if we want to, infinitely scaled access to the unscalable. The paradox of it, of course, is that it's all supposed to be about, you know, honest toil and, you know, the working class and, you know, accessibility and everything else. Of course, it's massively expensive because it's all handmade. It's, you know, arts and crafts stuff. You have to be very, very rich to afford arts and crafts furniture. It's a bit like there was a cartoon in the New Yorker years ago where two people in a restaurant and one saying to the other, Italian peasants must be very rich to be able to eat like this every day. You know, your Italian peasant food, $50 a meal, a dish.
Yeah.
And, you know, your handcrafted, authentic Sons of Toil furniture, 3 weeks of a working class man's salary.
Well, we've seen that argument, haven't we, during the pandemic of, you know, support your small businesses. Yes, but you have to be in a privileged position to support your small businesses because it costs a lot more than it does to hop over to Walmart and get what you need there or Target or wherever.
I mean, it's part of it is it's a cycle swinging back and forth. So, like, we want the fire hose, then we don't.
Yeah.
We want the mass manufacture perfection, then we don't. We want the network, then we just want the tool. Then we want the network, then we just want the tool. We want the one-off thing, and then we want 10,000 of them, and then we go back, we kind of swing back and forth.
We want choice, and then we want actually someone to make that choice for us so that we can sample the best of the best.
And that's sort of to the point of the sort of paradox of, like, newsletters as, like, the rebirth of blogging, which, of course, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, kill blogging. Then it all got too small and too short, and like you're buried in the algorithm. Now I'm going to write a thing, and it's going to be my thing, and it's going to be on this thing that I own, and I'm going to email it to you, and it's going to be in your Gmail, and it's going to be in your Gmail with 50 other of them, and you're not going to read it, and it's going to be in the newsletter tab. And then maybe we should have an algorithm, and we'll have a recommendation system maybe for all this kind of structured writing, and we then, and so the pendulum will just go round and round and round and round and round here. Which I don't, I read really reading the Substack guys, like I love them, it's a great product, but I'm not sure they really think a bit like that. Yeah. Like, what is it going to look like when you've got 10,000 people on your platform and everybody's got signed up to 200 newsletters? You're going to have an algorithm. You are. Or you're going to be MailChimp and you're going to say, it's not my problem, in which case, stop saying that you're democratizing publishing.
That's it. And that ties to something I think that we brought up once before, but this is also why you're starting to have more people who consider themselves curators of just like, I don't actually create any content, but I have a newsletter where I curate the top 10 articles in tech that I think is useful. And that's, I think, a way of getting out of the algorithm piece, but it's actually human beings saying, I know you well, and I know that this is what you want. But that's also, I don't know how that's a scalable thing.
It's funny, the other side of this is so... Eugene Y writes, Y or Way, I can't remember. He writes like one thing a year and it's always fantastic. And Sriram Krishnan does his interview site, which is one long, very, very long form interview with somebody really interesting in tech every couple of months. And Matthew Ball writes these, you know, I probably write two or three things a month, probably say two things a month at the moment. Matthew Ball does one much longer thing, probably every 2 months or something. I do a big annual macro presentation, which is like 100 slides, and that's a lot of different ideas all kind of condensed into one place and put into a story. So there are lots of kind of places you can be sort of along that spectrum of how much you write. And I'm going to forget other people. Like there's a lot of people who write. There's quite a lot of people who write like one great thing.
A year, yeah.
Twice a year.
Yeah.
And they're not trying to do any more than that. Fred Wilson writes something every day at the other end of the spectrum and isn't that active on Twitter, but he's always been said something interesting or intriguing on his website. And his website, Fred Wilson's website, interests me because it actually shows you how Twitter killed blogging. Because blogging, if you go back to the 2000s, it stood for weblog, and it was like a paragraph or a link, and a paragraph with a link, or it's maybe a picture or maybe video. So if I look at the archive of my website, like even back in like 2011-12, I might have done like 100 posts in a year because they were not like writing. It was, here's an interesting
chart. It was a thought.
And that went to Twitter, and that was also what a lot of Tumblr was. And so a lot of Tumblr goes to Instagram because it's basically, that was a lot of it wasn't, but you know, a big chunk of Tumblr was here are beautiful pictures. And that all went to Instagram or it went to Twitter. Maybe Facebook, I don't know. And but then with a network, but then the long form stuff sort of fades away, and then the long form stuff comes back again.
To your point, it's
so it's like how long, how short, how frequent, what kind of audience,
and which tools and platforms to distribute it on.
Yeah, many different axes of how you go about doing that, and we'll come back. It was a joke that somebody said that the most secure encryption on earth is anything you say in the second hour of your podcast.
Do you have something you want to share with us in the second hour of this podcast, Benedict?
Well, no, but you know, it is, you know, there's, you know, you can sit and talk for hours about this stuff. I mean, there was something
content stuff is interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. I mean, it's like, remember when, I mean, even the cycle of behavior within these platforms changes. So the site, you know, there was a time when your Facebook page, you did stuff on your Facebook profile, and we all installed these apps of like, what are your favorite movies and what countries have you been to? And all these social apps, and that partly got killed by it. But also like the Facebook page dies and it goes to becomes a feed. And then the news feed becomes photos, it becomes Instagram, and then that becomes stories, and then it becomes something else. And again, it's that cycle that your Facebook feed fills up, so you go to Instagram, and your Instagram feed fills up, so you go to stories, and your stories feed fills up,
else.
So you go to TikTok. Maybe that's something else. But that cycle just goes round and round and round.
And in this case, I love it, and we should probably end there, but this conversation came out of, hey, did you see Substack created and you got a new feature, the RSS feed? And it's fascinating to me how these features in these platforms prompt either new ways of using the platform, new ways of digesting the content, new ways of creating the content. And what does it actually mean? Like, why? What I thought was interesting is, wait, why the need to create an RSS feed? What did that come out of? What are we trying to solve here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's an old joke that like every Unix function became a company. So like get, and I'm not a Unix person, but like every Unix function became like a $1 billion company, and every Excel template, like file new in Excel, like new invoice, you know, new expense report, you know, all of those become, everything you see in the file new window in Excel becomes a $1 billion company. And also like every kind of cool social startup from the early 2000s becomes a company again now, but 100 times bigger. The thing I keep wondering is what happens is why has no one done Delicious again? So Flickr has happened again. Delicious hasn't happened again. I wish someone... No, I always found that was in... Maybe that was too nerdy. But like, you know, people keep... Again, this is a kind of recursive point here, but people keep reinventing the same stuff because the same problems keep coming around. But there's sort of an inherent problem in that by solving the problem, as soon as everybody uses it, then you've got the same problem then you've just recreated the problem and then you have to go and do it again. And you either do an algorithm and that just relocates the problem, or you go somewhere new, but then that will just happen again. I mean, I wrote this about the newsfeed, that Zuckerberg's law plus Dunbar's number. So Zuckerberg's law was that people share more stuff, if you can formalize it or dignify it as a law. But people share more stuff over time. And Dunbar's number is like, you know, 100, 150 people. And so the basic problem is like, you go on Facebook, you post something, you tap like on two things, you post a picture, you comment on somebody's feed. Okay, so you do five things a day. Okay, you've got 150 friends. So how many things are in your newsfeed? And so it turns out that the average Facebook user is eligible to see something over 1,000 items a day. And that is 150 people doing 10 things a day. Like, you click like, that's a thing. If you liked something, should I see that in my newsfeed? Well, if I've got 10 friends, like, there's a point in the development of the network where the answer is absolutely yes. And then there's a point where the answer is maybe, and how well do I know Tony and what did she like? And do I like those kinds of things? And then now, well done, now you've got an algorithm. And if you don't have an algorithm, I open Facebook and guess what? There's 1,500 unread things every fucking day.
And if you get overwhelmed or you don't like what you see, you go somewhere else.
And meanwhile, I have a collection of screenshots of the unread email. Have I shown you this? So I collect screenshots of people with unread emails. Like, and I've got like a dozen of these, which I just sort of seen at random. And it started with somebody I know who has 350,000 unread emails.
This is how I discovered that there's a point, isn't it a point where that number doesn't fit in anymore?
Well, it starts shrinking and they truncate the middle.
That's it.
If you make the font bigger on your iPhone, then it doesn't fit and it's like 3.0.
I think actually I do remember that, and that was the start. That was nearly the end of our friendship because I thought that was a pitch from your inbox and I was like, I can't. This is not going to work. Yeah, no. I was triggered. I was like, this is not going to work, Benedict, if you have 300,000.
At the moment, I have 7 emails in my inbox in total. Not unread, they're all read. I have 7 emails in my inbox. So I'm right at the other extreme of being weird. But what does it mean to say you have 375,000 unread emails in your inbox? And of course the answer is they're all like, you order something on Amazon, they send you, send it 7 emails, do I need to read them? But that's how that happens. But that cycle just goes round and round and round and round and round. And the only way to end it is to just like become a Carthusian monk and never talked to anyone.
I realized that the other day where I spent 2 hours actually going from reading Twitter, responding to a few things, going on to LinkedIn, then did a bit of Reddit, went back to Instagram, went to Instagram, did TikTok, and 2 hours had gone by and I was like, this is shit. I mean, it's not, because it's lovely and I learned so much and interacted with so many people, but this is not okay. And I know I'm not alone in this feeling, but
yeah.
But I do think the pandemic has exacerbated that, because there's also nowhere for me to go.
Yeah, I mean, I saw somebody say that the was this joke the other day that the Bible was the original doom scrolling, because it was a scroll.
Apologies to anyone.
Sorry. Yes, I was a punchline. I can't remember what the setup was, but yeah, it was like,
I like it.
Okay. So with that, doom scrolling goes back 2,500 years.
I think that's the title of our podcast.
So we're probably not going to solve it in Silicon Valley in 2021. Yeah, doom scrolling, the history of doom scrolling.
Love it. Talk to you next week.
Fantastic. Thank you. Speak to you later.